some of the questions that you get asked from the dozens or hundreds of clients.
Almost every most common question is, am I normal? Most commonly for couples, a mismatch or a kind of misalignment in desire. I feel like I have too much. I feel like I have not enough, or none is really, really common.
Psychosexual and relationship therapist,
Kate Moyle.
And co-founder of Pillow Play.
To talk about some of the taboo topics, things like erectile dysfunction, sexual inadequacies.
Is a member of COSRATS, the College of Sexual and Relationship Therapists.
Arousal is the body's physical process of preparing for sex, like neurochemical changes, changes in blood flow, sexual functioning.
What are some ways that you found has worked for couples to inject some of that novelty?
Well, the first thing is,
welcome to the show.
Thank you. Excited to be on.
So I was preparing some questions around what are some of the questions I should ask a leading sex therapist? And I thought I would flip the table over to you where I would ask, what are some of the questions that you get asked from the dozens or hundreds of clients? I would imagine you're seeing a pattern of what most people have in terms of questions in their minds.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think some of the most common, well, the most common question I think really, or what I feel is underneath almost every most common question is, am I normal? And it's a discussion that we based my book launch around. So we had a panel basically discussing this question and all the audience kind of got involved. And I think really that's at the heart of like a lot of people's sexual anxieties and insecurities is the fear that in some way they don't fit the norm that is expected of them. So whether that's that they're not, their body is not working in the way they want it to, that they don't think that they're feeling the way that they should do, that they're not having enough sex. Desire is one of the most common presenting problems that comes to therapy. So
what about desire specifically?
Well, that they, most commonly for couples, a mismatch or a kind of misalignment in desire, or I feel like I have too much, I feel like I have not enough, or none is really, really common. And I'm worried about what it is that I desire, or I desire something different to what I currently have. And what does that mean? And there's so much depth to kind of all of these questions. You know, we tackle them with what we call a biopsychosocial approach to understanding sex, which is, you know, the biological kind of physical components, the psychological and kind of cognitive, emotional components, and then the social world that we live in. And it's all of those things working together.
Talk to me about desire for a little bit. You talked about how people have this miscommunication around desire or how they feel about desire. I'm assuming this is during the relationship where obviously they got together because there was some form of desire, attraction, compatibility. And as you progress through the relationship, the desire isn't as static as people think it is continuously throughout, you know, the honeymoon period and after. It's deformed, it's changed in some way. Is that normal, I guess, is that question. Is desire a fluidity thing rather than a static thing?
Yeah, absolutely. A fluidity thing is the perfect way to describe it. So desire is always in context. And what we say when we mean desire, we're talking about the motivation, the kind of psychological moving towards or inclination to be sexual, to have a sexual experience. So that psychological component, whereas arousal is the body's physical process of preparing for sex. And so that's kind of things like neurochemical changes, changes in blood flow, sexual functioning. And often we confuse those two things. Now, they're two different processes, but they often happen at the same time as well. But what we fear and what so many people present for therapy with is a loss of desire when actually they're experiencing a change of desire. And desire can be both responsive, which is that we start something and it emerges in response to what's happening. So we start kind of kissing or touching, and then we notice that we start to kind of lean into that experience rather than feeling that rush of desire first and then acting on it, which is something that we describe as more spontaneous. But the difficult thing, the thing that people the thing that people feel challenged by is at the start of relationships, there is often a lot of spontaneous desire, or what feels like it's very spontaneous, but actually we're triggering it because we're giving each other more attention, more touch, sexual currency is high, we're kind of more focused on each other, there's a novelty, there's excitement, you know, we're kind of throwing everything into that experience. And as the relationship starts to settle a bit, so does desire, and it moves into that more responsive style. But what we think is because what we don't have anymore or don't have as often as what you described, the honeymoon period, is that that must be an indicator that something is wrong. Whereas actually what we should be equipping people with is the knowledge that this is totally fine and totally normal, and actually we can do lots with it and about it.
Yeah, and people kind of claim, I think it's like 6 months that's supposed to be the honeymoon period. Like, where did that period come from? Is that something just a popular concept that was popularized, or is there something to it? Are there studies that after a period of time, let's say 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, that there's something chemically in our brain that doesn't really have the same triggering effects, or maybe that's certain times where the novelty has worn off, actually, like in our biological brains or anything like that? Or is it just a concept?
So there is an extra kind of chemical that we have at the start of relationships called PEA, which fades kind of over time, is thought to fade around the kind of 6 months to a year mark. So there is a chemical component, but also, you know, when we're doing all of those things at the start of a relationship, you know, we're kissing, we're touching, we're having sex, we're getting oxytocin release, you know, we've got lots of dopamine going on because it feels good, we're experiencing pleasure. Lots of those things are creating this sense of high. And we know from the work of Helen Fisher that attraction, attraction and attachment, so these different stages of getting to know someone, do have different chemical profiles. And that is a really interesting thing for us to know, because I think when we feel we're not getting that charge so much, which we can read a lot into, then that might mean we start thinking, okay, what does that mean? You know, I'm not getting that kind of rush in the way that I feel like I used to. But I think there is also a social bit, which is that we really kind of put on a pedestal those really intense relationships, you know, the start of relationships where we're completely obsessed with each other, where we drop everything else, where they're our only priority. It's very romantic. It's the stuff of movies and, you know, numerous Netflix series. And so I think that it's actually those two things in combination.
Yeah, it's the expectations of what, you know, either the man or the woman expected to have from the feelings that they had or what they've seen on screen to the reality. And so oftentimes, no one can really meet the expectations of what their fantasies have revealed.
No way. And I think Esther Perel talks about this a lot. She talks about how we expect one person to provide what the village used to provide us, you know, what numerous people used to provide us. And, you know, in a way, what we're doing is we're setting up our relationships and our partners to fail, because no person can be everything that we need them to be, you know, the co-parent, the lover, the best friend, the kind of person we run the house with, the kind of sounding board, the gym buddy, the person who shares all our hobbies, that we do everything with, that we put all of these expectations on one person to be everything. And of course, then they're going to fail us in some way, because nobody can be everything for everyone. And we know that actually relationships with other people, friends, family, can be really supportive in relationships. But it's something that lots of experts talk about, which is how do we, you know, think about it as so embedded into the language, you know, the one, you know, our other half. Does that mean we were only half a person before we met them? And does that mean if the relationship ends that we're now only half a person again? But even those, you know, in the language of how we talk about these things, it's quite embedded as a message.
Right. Yeah. The nomenclature of all this is kind of limiting us to these definitions. And I also personally have struggled with relationships because of a lot of the things that you mentioned in the book, But one of the things that we just spoke about was desire. You know, you have that fling of attraction from physical to emotional to spiritual, all of these things. Everything is new. Everything that you've done, you know, with this person is a new experience every week. And then around that 6 to 9 month mark, things kind of become stale. And maybe stale is the wrong word, but like you're kind of doing the same thing. A lot of that is because you have busy schedules and it's hard to keep novel things going all the time. Mm. And I think that's hopefully, you know, that's something that is, well, I guess that's pretty normal, I think, for most people. But I associated that as not being attracted to that person anymore for a while. I thought, oh, this is just, maybe this is my problem. Maybe I'm not built for having a committed relationship. Maybe I'm not built for having long-term relationships because I don't feel the same chemical reactions for this person anymore. And I really thought there was something wrong. And maybe I thought because of previous travel experiences, I'm just kind of the person that is always seeking novel things more than maybe the average person. Turns out it's probably not. And, you know, speaking of Perel, she has this quote where she says, all of us will fall in love with multiple partners in our lives. Some fall in love with multiple people while others fall in love with the same person over and over again. And that really shifted my mindset around the perspective of finding new ways to appreciate your partner and new ways to fall in love with them. Talk to me a little bit about that. And am I normal in having those experiences that I did before?
I love that quote. And it just, it makes so much sense, doesn't it? We're not the same person we were in our 20s to our 30s. You know, we go through house move, country moves, job moves, having kids, not having kids, you know, financial worries, ill health. You know, it makes sense that as people we're kind of constantly shifting and therefore our relationships are going to shift in line with that. I think it's such a good quote. And I think so many people describe what you just described, which is, okay, once the initial excitement, kind of lust, attraction phase has gone and we're settling into the relationship a bit, I feel like I want something new again. I feel like I want something exciting again. And we know that as humans that we habituate, we get used to things, we kind of settle in. That's how we learn. But we also know that we love novelty and excitement and things that are new and things that sparkle curiosity. And so it's kind of like we're kind of working out how to manage those two things when it comes to relationships that are long-term and particularly monogamous relationships. You know, of course we get used to people. Of course we get familiar. Of course we settle into routines because that's what we do. And also most of us are going to work every day or working in some capacity or parenting or living our lives, which require at least an element of routine. You know, our days are organized by certain routines. And I think that it's then about, okay, so how do we inject the erotic, the fun, the novelty? And part of that is paired with the lack of the conversation about the fact that relationships and sex lives do take some work and that this stuff doesn't just happen and that we do have to kind of consciously think about it a bit sometimes. But again, because A, there's a lack of kind of mainstream normalized conversation about that, but B, all the versions of sex and relationships that we see are very glamorized, then we feel like we don't have realistic comparisons. So therefore we assume that we as the individual or the couple must be the problem.
Yeah. What are some ways that you found has worked for couples that have been together for a year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years that make it easy for them to inject some of that novelty into their daily habits or daily relationships? What are some of the tips that have worked for them?
Well, the first thing is it has to be intentional. And I think that's one of the, you know, that's the thing that we don't really want to hear. We think that if we're having to be intentional about it, that in itself is an indicator of a problem, in the way that we think if we have to talk about sex, it's because we're struggling or because there's a problem. You know, we only talk about this when it's going wrong. And I think that things like the Gottmans talk about a 6-second kiss, a 10-second hug. So they call it a kiss with potential. And I think that that's really great. An increase in sexual currency, which are the things like that. So things that you do with a partner, which are building your sexual relationship, but are not sex. So
can you talk about that a little bit more? The 10-second hug you said, 6-second kiss. I haven't heard of that before.
Yeah. So the Gottmans, who are some of the biggest researchers and have done longitudinal studies on sex and relationships, identified things that couples are doing in relationships and helping them to build connection. So things like a 6-second kiss. So instead of the peck on the lips, kind of out the door, you know, have a good day. You give each other a 6-second kiss. So it's just a long enough time to have connection, but they describe it as a kiss with potential. And a 10-second hug is, again, it's just allowing yourselves to just give yourselves 10 seconds to connect. And I think it's even more important in the kind of hyper-productive, super busy modern lives that we're all living, that we do often just kind of rush past each other and we forget to have those little moments. And they're little moments of physical connection. And sexual currency, which I just explained, what we do is we think about keeping sexual currency high, and that also offers a boost for desire, opportunities for responsive desire to be triggered. But it's also keeping that gap between people closer than if we wouldn't be doing those things, so that it doesn't feel that kind of sex is something that bridges a huge gap. And they are the ways of connecting physically, so kissing, touching, you know, flirting, hand-holding, cuddling up next to each other, that allow us to kind of melt also from sensuality into sexuality. And so a colleague of mine, Dr. Karen Gurney, who wrote a book called Mind the Gap, talks about how an exercise that you can do is you can really kind of intensify your sexual currency. So you can really lean into kind of filling up the money box of currency, so to speak, by making sure you intentionally do it a lot, and you'll start to notice that you feel a lot closer. And that in itself will be something which can lead to feeling more open towards each other and more desiring, because you're starting to feel more connected, if sex particularly is something that you're struggling with.
Yeah. Well, speaking of opening up, I think you mentioned it before that when you bring up something to a partner and ask that, you want something more novel. You want something that's more exciting. If you are a year into the relationship or more, and this is your first time having that conversation, you're right. Like, it's the first trigger that someone gets when they hear that is, oh, something is wrong in the relationship. This person might want to break up. This is like a warning sign. Mm. How do we communicate to our partners? Ideally, this is something you have a conversation from day one. But if you haven't had this conversation, what is like the right way to have that, or start at least that discussion, that you want to set up this foundation of doing new things together and novelty without potentially triggering something?
I think so few couples are having this conversation from day one. And I think it's something I wish that we encouraged people to do, and we helped people to be equipped to know how to do. I always talk about starting with a positive. So I love what we're doing. I'm really enjoying this. I loved it when we did that. Do you remember that time? So starting it also as a conversation, not in the moment when you're about to have sex or have just had sex. So take it out of the bedroom and say to your partner, you know, I often talk about using conversations, so whether it's podcast, article, TED Talk, as a springboard. So saying, I listened to this thing today and they were talking about this. What do you think about that? Or would you be interested in trying it? Or I'd love to try that with you. Because the minute we go into a conversation with our partners saying, I don't think this is working at the moment, or I don't feel good about this, or you're not good enough at this, once your partner feels criticized, they're going to shut down. That's kind of end of the conversation, or at least end of a productive conversation. Whereas if we are able to start it in a kind of warm, open, and kind of confirming way. Mm. You know, we all know what it feels like to feel on the kind of receiving end of criticism. It doesn't feel good, and we don't really want to be there anymore. And so it's about kind of bringing it in that way, but also giving your partner a chance to perhaps think about it and come back to you, or you to say, you know what, I've really been thinking about, let's pick sex toys as an example, about how it might be quite fun for us to try some sex toys together. Like, how do you feel about that? And you've had a bit of time to think about that and a bit of time to think about the fact you're preparing for that. Your partner's hearing it for the first time. They might be like, oh, I'm not sure, actually. Could I have a think about it? Or what would you be interested in trying? Or, and if they have a sudden, you know, if in their first instances, they feel a bit unsure, like, okay, that's fine. I've been thinking about it for a bit. So I just thought I'd see how you feel. And just let them settle with it, or let them just kind of think about it for a minute, because you're a step ahead, because you're the one who's had the idea.
Right, right. You don't want to, you want to slowly lead that in. And I like the way you put that, which is instead of saying, hey, our sex life probably needs some improvement, you're maybe bringing up a good memory that you've done before, where you kind of bring it up with those good memories rather than leading with the negative. So it does create that overall positive experience for that conversation to be more open so that it can lead somewhere. Ultimately.
Also to focus on, I really want to try this with you. I think it would be fun for us to try. You know, those are positive slants on that conversation. Also, hey, is there anything you're interested in trying? Is there anything that you've been thinking about? You know, it's two-way. It's listening and talking.
Yeah. So there's this novelty piece that you brought up. When you see couples that seems, there are rare few that are able to keep this excitement, this honeymoon phase over years, if not decades. You know, do you think novelty is at that core piece of doing that and making that last? Novelty, not in the sense of that everything is always new, but having that foundation in place where they're both experimentative, open, communicative, or are there other things that you've seen from your work and talking to clients?
I think it's about curiosity. And I think it's not, I don't think it's also about the honeymoon period lasting a really long time. Because everything else in the relationship changes as well. So I think it's not about extending the honeymoon period. It's about, I think a bit what we said earlier about what Esther says about us, is about nurturing the erotic. And for me, there are two things. One is the curiosity bit and one is the intentionality bit. And the curiosity is not assuming you know everything about your partner so you stop trying to learn anything new about them. And I think we all are guilty of it. You know, I'm a relationship and psychosexual therapist, and there's definitely, you know, a lot of times where I need to take that advice myself, and I talk about this for a living. And so I think that it's because we get so familiar and so used to each other that we kind of forget to check stuff out with them. We forget to show interest or be interested. And I love lots of companies like The School of Life. And I think the other one is called Are We Really Strangers? They have card games.
Oh, yeah. We have that game. Yeah. It's great.
They're really great because they are kind of packs of like hundreds of questions that you just wouldn't ask each other normally. And they're prompts. And you're always going to discover something new about each other. And, you know, I sometimes say to couples, okay, well, I want you to go away this week and write 5 questions down, completely random questions, put them in a bowl and sit for an evening and either do one a day or sit and kind of do them all in one evening and just spend 5 minutes per answer, you know, talking to each other, giving each other your full attention and being like, oh, I didn't know that about you. Or, I had no idea that. And it's about that. And also lots of experts talk about building new hobbies together, either independently or as a couple, outside of sex. Because again, it's about seeing your partner in a new light, seeing them in a new way, in a different way. And that isn't introducing novelty. Novelty isn't, you know, trying everything new sexually and kind of going to a sex toy shop and buying every outfit and every toy and every new product. And I think those versions of the idea of spicing it up actually quite intimidate people and then they don't want to do anything about it. And so, you know, if it comes to sex, it can be something like changing one thing every time you have sex. And that one thing could be having the lights on or the lights off, or starting with your clothes on or your clothes off, or a different room of the house. You know, it doesn't, these are not big things, but they're very good at giving us a sense of keeping moving rather than being stuck in a routine.
Right. Just small things, like, because it is a lot of pressure for someone to think that, oh my God, every week I have to do this this, you know, candlelit room, and then every time it has to be a different flavor, or like, you know, all these different pressures that people get. But you're saying small things that allow you to, you know, see something that is a little bit different for the other person.
Small things that are achievable, that don't cost money, that we don't have to check, you know, literally turning the lights on or the lights off, or starting, you know, so many couples kind of take all their clothes off and then get into bed. Undress each other instead of taking your clothes off yourselves, or, you know, put the kind of start making out on the sofa instead of on the bed, or put the kids to bed and then go to bed for half an hour before you have dinner instead of having dinner and then going to bed before you go to sleep. And kind of having your couple time then, or, you know, having a shower before, or lighting a candle, or having music on. They're small little things that we can achieve. And I think the thing is if as soon as we become kind of anxious or feel like what we're doing kind of has to be a big thing, we're actually less inclined to do it. And we might feel like we're mixing stuff up too much, or what is our partner going to think if I suggest this? It could be, you know, using lube or not, introducing a sex toy, deciding to try a different position or have a different type of sex that day, or being like, right, we're not going to have intercourse for this week, but we're going to do lots of different other types of touch and play. You know, there's so many variations for what we can do.
Yeah. And it seems more sustainable to have those smaller tweaks of changes that you can do more frequently rather than massive changes, because you're always going to need to up the game, which is, it's not sustainable. And there's just so much pressure, which means that you're not really going to enjoy those moments because you're constantly thinking about the next thing that you have to change up all the time. What about intensity and frequency? I read this, I listened to this podcast from Andrew Huberman, who talks about this book, which I think is called Can Love Last? And they did this study where couples that have been together for decades and have, you know, high sexual attraction and desire were doing these on and off experiments where they would touch each other intensely for 2 weeks and then not touch each other at all for the next 2 weeks. And then it would kind of go back and forth where they would have intensity and then pause, intensity and then pause. Is there some science to that, of not varying novelty of different positions or whatnot, but just reducing or just having intense on and off moments, kind of like couples that maybe one person is traveling and they don't see each other for a month or 2 months, and then they get back together and then it's, you know, intensity of seeing each other. I have friends that couples that do that as well. What's kind of the thinking behind that?
I wouldn't know exactly what the thinking is behind that, but I would love to read that book. And funnily enough, you're like the second person that's spoken to me about it recently, which made me think I need to go and get it. But I imagine, you know, we know that, so that we're kind of biologically primed for connection in terms of things like increased eye contact, touch, kissing, sex, orgasm. They're all things that release oxytocin and those kind of bonding hormones. So we would probably feel, you know, a lot closer in that period of intensity of touch. You know, I think it's triggering that responsive desire. It's kind of bridging that gap between sex. All those things we've talked about previously, but kind of happening really intensely. And I think that, you know, the added layer on top of that is the modern world we live in means that the majority of the time, most of us are slightly distracted by our phones. You know, we're sitting on the sofa with the TV on next to our partners. We're both on our phones. We're in bed together. We're both on our phones. We're, you know, we're missing those opportunities and those invitations a lot of the time. And so that's the social bit. And then the kind of biological bit is we're leaning into those kind of priming, those neurochemical releases. And I would imagine with an experiment like that, the intention is those 2 weeks of kind of touch deprivation are about missing that person, about wanting it, and that in itself, that anticipation, which is the most natural, you know, human aphrodisiac that we have, is building up, and that in itself then becomes a motivation or a desire boosting element.
Yeah, I think about kind of the quality of the time that you spent together by doing that, and also the novelty. It kind of ticks two boxes in some sense, because novelty, not in the sense like this is a completely different person when you see them, but in that you haven't seen them for a month or 2 months or 2 weeks, or you haven't had sex for 2 weeks or something. And there is that break that allows you to kind of miss it a little bit. Mm. And also the quality of it when you do spend time together. So it's the quality of time rather than the quantity of time. And actually my girlfriend and I, we also live separately. We've lived together and then we will live separately. I don't think this is a very common thing. So this is not couple advice for anyone. This is just something that we're, I guess, experimenting with. But it's kind of that idea of when we do see each other now, there is more intensity, more quality of time where we're fully present, right? Whether we're actually going out for dinner versus when we were living together, it is something where we would see each other around the house all the time. Mm-hmm. And we would, you know, we would rather just order in rather than going out for dinner, dressing up, going to new spots. So there is something where, you know, it's something that we're experimenting with, I guess, at the end of the day. But
yeah, I think
this
right.
was kind the of inspired
time.
By that.
Yeah, I think yeah. the quality time is a great point. And I think, you know, that we do get complacent when we're around each other all the time. You know, we do kind of forget, I think, to pay attention. And that's a big thing in relationships. You know, we often see people kind of describing that idea of like, I don't really think my partner sees me. I don't think that they, you know, I don't think my partner thinks I'm attractive anymore. They'd pay me no attention. You know, I could walk past them completely naked and they wouldn't even look up from their phone. And, you know, we often hear those stories from people, and it's that sense of I'm no longer visible. You know, I've been here so much, or we're so used to each other that we just don't even notice each other anymore. And then, you know, there's that someone else notices me, or suddenly it feels very exciting to be seen by someone else or to be noticed. And, you know, as humans, we like to be seen. We like to know we're special, to know that we're important to someone. And I think so one of the other main pieces of research from John and Julie Gottman, so the people that I was mentioning earlier, was around, they call it bids for attention. So they did a longitudinal study and they studied couples, and they followed up at 6 years later to see who was together, who was kind of happily married, or who was kind of unhappily married. And what they identified, or what they could predict, was that the couples that in the original stages of the experiment who turned towards when their partners made bids for attention were, and I think it was something like 67% of the time versus 37% of the time. I can't remember the exact statistics, but there was like a big gap. And the couples who turned towards, so the partner said, hey, and they looked up and were like, hi, what's up? Or can I get your cup of tea? Or so whatever it was, that the partner stopped what they were doing and turned towards their partner, noticed, took note, responded to the bid. So turned towards, as they call it. Those were the couples that were still together at the 6 year point. The couples who either kind of ignored or turned away were the ones who were broken up or were kind of unhappily still together.
Wow, and I think that's a huge difference.
Huge difference. And I think it's a real landmark study. And I think the interesting thing about it is, think how now we have handheld technology, phones, iPads, you know, we're mostly in relationship with our devices, is a kind of slightly grim but realistic way of looking at it. Mm-hmm. So how much are we doing that? You know, how much has that increased for couples in this day and age? You know, how much is that becoming the norm? And I think it's an interesting thing for us to kind of take note of.
Yeah. Can you kind of elaborate more on that bids for attention? So could that just be like a text message that someone gets that isn't answered in the right frame of mind, or like the right time frame? Could it be, you know, I guess the obvious one is someone actually calls you their name and asks for something. That's probably the most obvious form of rejection if someone doesn't actually listen to you. What are exactly those bids for attention? Were there any specificity there in the Gottman research?
They were studying it in terms of in person, so rather than things like kind of texts and calls. But I think that adds another layer, and it's something you totally hear couples talking about, you know, and things in therapy. And they'll say, like, you know, I called them 6 times and they didn't pick up, but I know that they were X or Y. And, you know, there's obviously the assumptions about what someone's doing rather than replying to us, or rather than us being a priority to go back to, I think also load into that. But I think it was things like, you know, kind of saying something to each other or reaching out to one another or asking for something. And it's that, you know, like, how's your day? How's your day? Fine. Rather than saying, how's your day? Oh yeah, it was good. Like, you know, like this happened, blah, blah, blah. But how was yours? It's kind of, you know, that being a 2 minute exchange has much more meaning than, yeah, it was fine. And that person just going back to what they're doing. That's kind of a buffer, isn't it? It's a kind of, and almost a non-response.
Yeah. Yeah. I think Jordan Peterson also talks about this. I don't know, I don't want to butcher the exact statistics, but it was certainly healthy couples that are able to at least have an hour of conversation per week, not about the relationship, not about their sex life, not about any of those things that revolve, you know, desire or, you know, or compatibility around the relationship, but just around their normal lives, like friends, like people catching up, are more likely to stay together over the long haul. And I think it's kind of what you mentioned, is just being able to have conversations as two people, as friends that are able to talk about their lives without any attachments, without any, you know, thing leading to sex or anything like that.
Well, the colleague of mine that I mentioned earlier, who wrote the book Mind the Gap, Dr. Karen Gurney, she's just written a new book about how not to let kids ruin your sex life. And one of the things that she talks about is how the WhatsApp chat is just like, can you do this? Can you pick up this? Can you do this? I did that. What about this? Can you take them to there? And it's, you know, this permanent kind of to-do list, which is a lot of parents' experience. And there's very little room for like, how are you doing? Like, shall we do this? Like, how are you feeling? It's like, we just need to do everything all the time and stay on top of everything. And that requires this kind of back and forth constantly. And how that is really desire dampening. I mean, there's very zero kind of wanting in that. And it becomes very functional. And I think that, you know, we see that people go through these stages. And again, the Gottmans reported that, I think it's 67% of people described their relationship, that a relationship kind of downturn in the first 3 years of their children's lives, that those were some of the most challenging relationship years, that had a negative effect on their relationship in the first 3 years of their children's lives. And, you know, it's a huge amount, but, you know, you've gone through this transformational experience and suddenly, you know, you've had time for each other, attention for each other, and everything has shifted. Your roles, your day-to-day life, your financial commitments, you know, your time commitments, your sleep, and the impact you have as a, you know, on a couple, if it's a couple in this instance, is huge. But we don't quite know, you know, in terms of relationship satisfaction, actually it's a time that we're at an all-time low.
Yeah. Do you think that couples that have a second child or a third child are able to manage that more easily because by the second time and this third time, they have some idea of how to manage everything? Like, my brother just had his second born and he just knows exactly what to do this time around. He knows, he's already got the books, he already has all the places to buy the stuff, and they've kind of got a system already, more better than first time parents. And because of that, maybe they have some more time. I don't know if this actually applies, because I guess maybe they're busier now because they have two kids. But you're basically saying that couples that are able to have that time together or to catch up and to have time for each other are more likely to stick around, as Dr. Peterson said.
I think that it's, I don't know if I think the first child to second child, that I think that I have two children. So I kind of feel like, and you know, from personal experience, I almost feel like the two things were completely different because everything changes when you have a first child because it's so unknown. But then when you have a second child, you're kind of pulled in so many more directions. And I think that it's about, during that time, just being able to find little pockets for yourselves as a couple, and also to remind yourself that you're a couple and not just, you know, mum and dad, or dad and dad, or mum and mum, or, you know, mum and stepdad, or you know whatever kind of configuration of relationship you have, because you can get so stuck in just a parent role. And then to kind of come out of that and remember that you're a couple again within that unit. And I think it's, you know, we're not kind of hoping for something unrealistic, which is that you can be like that all the time, you know, and there's so much joy also to be gained in co-parenting and being parents and, you know, or if you're a single parent, being a parent on your own. But I think it's about remembering that you can have that other side of yourselves as well. And, you know, a lot of that is also where desire thrives. You know, for lots of parents, they're reporting these struggles with their sex lives. And if you think about it, it's because a lot of the stuff that needs doing, and, you know, it's not just the looking after the child, it's all the everything that goes with it. They're not very desire provoking things, you know, very few people kind of. And, you know, like we say about household chores, and I think interesting you saying that kind of living apart means you don't have to see each other doing all of those things. I don't think very many people feel that watching their partner kind of take the bins out is sexy or motivating or, and, you know, doing laundry, et cetera, like, or paying bills. You know, these are not things that desire kind of thrives from, but they are things that we all need to do in order to manage our lives.
Yeah, I've also heard from a parenting angle, when you feel like you're a parent of the other partner, there is two different forms of love, right? Where you have the, I love you, you know, I love you as a person and I want to take care of you, you know, I want to make sure you're safe. But there's something around knowing that the person is independent without you, that that person can thrive and take care of themselves, that is what sparks desire. Right. It kind of sparks that first time you met where you aren't having to take care of, you know, their appointments or take out the garbage for them. And you need that both to have that desire and attraction still, you know, fling around instead of just being the parent or the, maybe parent's the wrong word, but it's the caretaker.
Yes. And often people say that they experience desire for their partner when they see them in a different context. So something like in a work context or giving a speech, best man at a wedding, let's say. And often people say, God, I thought my partner looked really hot up there. Or I noticed when other people were kind of interested in them that suddenly I, you know, felt more desire for them, or I felt kind of really excited but we're seeing them in a different context. We're seeing them as, you know, a bit like how you're saying, like we used to see them. And that's why we know that desire is context dependent. It's often why people say they have more sex on holiday. They're out of their daily routine, their daily life. They have, you know, a change of scene, a change of feeling. They don't have to do so much. They're in a different place. There's so much going on. It's not because their libido or kind of physically anything has changed, you know, overnight because they took a flight. It's because they're in a different headspace.
Right. And I'm curious to know how far that perception goes. So you talk about seeing someone in a new light because it's for the sake of novelty. But like for someone like, let's say, Beyonce and Jay-Z, Jay-Z seeing Beyonce perform, some of the wildest performances that anyone probably would have ever seen live, but seeing your partner do it, but he probably has now seen that 50 times, maybe 100 times, no matter how amazing it is because of the fact that they've been together for so long. Or Michelle Obama seeing Barack Obama do a speech in front of millions of people and inspiring a nation. Does that also get old? Like, is it all just a perception thing? No matter what level you get to, it's really just at the end of the day, our minds. And Jay-Z is also needing novelty, or same with Michelle Obama needing novelty from Barack Obama. I mean, it's ridiculous to say, but I wonder at what level, you know, to that extent.
I think you have to ask Jay-Z and Michelle.
I'll let you know what they say.
I don't want to speak for them, but I mean, I would imagine the thing is, it's what it's about is seeing your partner through someone else's eyes. And in those instances, you know, I suppose your partner is being seen through the eyes of different people all of the time. And I think that it's a reminder, you know, I think a lot of it is also about memory, which is a reminder of how we used to see our partner or how we might have seen our partner. And I think there is something, you know, something very nostalgic isn't quite the right word, but very kind of connecting about that. You know, often couples therapy, we might say to people, kind of tell us your story, tell us about how you first met or how you guys fell in love, when you were first attracted to each other. It's about understanding and also sometimes reminding couples that those moments were there, because they're so stuck that all they can see is their current context and what's going on around them and the struggles that they're having currently. They've kind of forget that there was good.
Sure, sure. I want to shift to sex, which is the main topic of the book. Mm. And one of the situations, and I'm sure this varies, because it certainly has varied for me for different partners, is your sex libido. And having a conversation around that as well. You know, I've been with partners that where their sexual libido was lower than mine, much lower. And I've been with partners that have had much higher sex libidos. And I guess mine kind of falls somewhere in the middle, and it actually kind of changes depending on the partner that I'm with. Mm. It almost seems like the lower they are, the higher my sexual libido goes. And then the higher they are, mine kind of is comparing themselves to their sexual libido. It kind of feels like it's a lot lower. I guess number one, is that quite common? And how do couples have a conversation around that? And is that something that they can overcome if the libido differences is so large?
Yeah, and you know, a mismatch in, and what it feels like you're describing, correct me if I'm wrong, is the regularity of sex that would be ideal for each partner.
Yeah.
So kind of frequency or regularity. And couples being not perfectly sexually aligned in terms of this is the norm. You know, to have people who are perfectly sexually aligned in relationship together, although they might be for a kind of short period of time perhaps, or at the start of a relationship, is much more unlikely than not being perfectly sexually aligned. So one of the things that we're constantly working with couples to do is to, how do they navigate the mismatch? How do they navigate the difference? And not really a surprise to me that you're saying that you notice it changes. And then obviously I think, you know, sometimes the less we have something, the more we want something. So you might be like, you know, I'm noticing that I want this more, but it's because I feel like I'm not getting it so much. And in order for me to get it, I have to kind of say that I want it more. And so there's that kind of, those dynamics I think are quite common in couples. And also we see that, and I know it's a very couple kind of focused conversation rather than people not in relationships, but we also see that typically in relationships that there's an initiator. So often one partner will start sex more, or start kind of indicating them already for sex more. And we know that sex in itself is actually a motivation rather than like a kind of primary drive. Mm. And so we're motivated to do something more, which makes us feel good, which we enjoy more, that kind of gives us benefits. And the why of that is going to be, that's the psychological bit, is also different for different people. So some people are like, oh, it's just not that important to me. You know, it's something I enjoy every now and again, but I don't feel like I need to have sex with my partner to know that they love me, or to feel validated, or to feel attractive to them, or to feel secure in my relationship. Those are things I just know, and sex kind of comes quite low down the priority list for me. Whereas other people might say, for me, sex is the way I know that my partner loves me, the way we feel connected, the way I know this is a relationship and not a friendship, the way that I feel confident in myself, the way that I feel attractive and satisfied, or the way that I relieve stress. And there's hundreds of reasons. You know, one of my favorite pieces of research identified 237 reasons for why people said they had sex. And I think so often we kind of pigeonhole sex into like, it must be these, you know, it must be because I want to have sex, or I want to get pregnant, or I want, you know, the variety of reasons people have sex is huge.
Right, right. I would imagine. I would like to know, what are the most unique ones that you found?
The one in that study, it's a study done in 2007 by someone called Bass and Meston. It's called Why Humans Have Sex. My favorite was because someone said they wanted to stay warm.
Valid.
Yeah.
Valid. Depending on where they are. If they're in the UK right now, I mean.
I mean, if they're in the UK, definitely put on some socks and have sex.
Around that differentiation, obviously the best way is to communicate it, but is there some correlation between someone's love language and how much sex means to them in the relationship? So for someone that has physical touch, very high in the importance of how they receive love or quality time spent versus maybe someone that has acts of service or what's the other one?
Gifts, words of affirmation.
Gifts, words of affirmation. Mm. Something that's not as physical. Do you feel that there is some correlation there?
Yeah, I think there definitely is. And I think it's two things. I think one is if we take a lot from that kind of like physical affection and touch, that's going to create desire sometimes, you know, that's going to promote that responsive desire, that kind of feeling of closeness, the sexual currency, all the things we spoke about at the start, but also that person might be more kind of prone to want to lean in physically to another person to have that physical connection, and that sex can be a part of that. The quality time, I think, as well, you know, if it's that sex becomes a result of quality time or kind of that togetherness. But I think there are kind of so many kind of theories as to why. But yeah, I can think if we put more physical, you know, more importance on the physical, then we can understand that sexual intimacy is, and sex intimacy and physical intimacy are going to be a part of that. But it's also about how couples navigate it, because if you've got one partner who kind of puts the pressure on, or they're saying like, oh, I need this, and the other partner's so far apart, how do we navigate that? Because the minute that sex becomes a pressure point for any reason, whether it's to do with the relationship kind of being in jeopardy or kind of at risk because one partner's saying like, look, I need some kind of physical intimacy for me to be in this relationship, whether it's because sex has become problematic, because there's a dysfunction or there's pain. So there are sexual dysfunctions, but also side effects of medications or things like cancer treatments or certain medication groups. People might have had surgeries or an accident. You know, the list goes on and on and on. The minute that we start to feel pressure around sex, you know, trying to conceive being a perfect example, sex can very quickly become something that we don't desire, that we would rather avoid, that makes us feel stressed, that makes us feel anxious. And that can be really problematic because it's then paired with the fact that often we don't know how to talk about it. So how do we explain to the person? How do we explain to the person that we've been having sex with for 5 years that suddenly we feel really anxious about it because we're having a bit of a crisis of confidence about ourselves because we got passed up for that promotion at work. We kind of brought it home with us. We're feeling really stressed, you know, a bit downtrodden, that kind of going into a sexual situation where we're slightly kind of off elsewhere psychologically. And then we notice that we're struggling to get an erection and our partner's saying, hey, what's going on? This has never happened before. How do we explain that? And these are really common things that I hear about, you know, the outside life leaking into sex and sex, you know, outside kind of struggles leaking into sex and kind of sexual struggles leaking out into outside life. You know, we know that this mental health kind of sexual wellness connection is very, very strong. But again, it's something that's so rarely discussed.
Yeah. Yeah. And I wonder if, I mean, this is really just from my own perspective, but there are periods where I've also faced different events in my life and stress has creeped in, nothing to do with the partner. And that leads to lack of sleep sometimes. And when I've done measurements, I have noticeable lower testosterone at that time as well. And lower testosterone would also mean I have less energy and oftentimes I have less sex drive. Mm-hmm. And there's all these things that are happening, but it does some ego damage to talk about that with your partner. Mm-hmm. And you don't want to, number one, you already have other stresses that you're dealing with, but to have that conversation just adds on that extra pressure and stress. So I would imagine I can only speak to guys, that guys often have a very difficult time to talk about this because of the fact that it is hurting their ego, it is hurting their confidence and what their partner might perceive them as if they were to talk about these things.
Mm-hmm. That's all links to the biopsychosocial bit. So you've just given the perfect example. So the biological component, the social component, and then you're worrying about it. So the biological component kind of changes in hormone levels, feeling high stress, you know, perhaps having higher cortisol, not sleeping so well because of the stress. So also, you know, think about the back and forth. Like you get stressed about not sleeping so much. Not sleeping so much makes you stress more, you know, feel the stress more, your body's more under strain. The social element is, I don't want to talk to my partner about this, or how do I talk to my partner about this? Or I'd rather not talk to my partner about this. The psychological bit, you know, this is damaging my ego. I'm not feeling so good about myself. I felt like I'm struggling. What does that mean? So that kind of psychological processing. So you've got all of those things happening at once, which is why, you know, we as psychosexual therapists kind of look at stuff with this lens. And it's just the perfect example of how if we kind of were able to say to our partners, do you know what, I'm really struggling in general at the moment. I'm feeling really stressed. This isn't about you. This is about me. And I'm just finding this really hard. I'm noticing that I'm kind of less interested in sex. So Emily Nagoski's work, we know, shows that kind of, you know, 80 to 90% of people, when they're stressed, don't feel that they want sex so much, aren't as motivated to have sex. And so we kind of see that the decline in desire or wanting for sex is correlated with stress. But maybe for that kind of 10 to 20% of other people, how they deal with stress might be by having sex as a form of stress relief. Right. But I always talk about how having a conversation with our partner is about sex is like talking in a language we've never been taught. You know, we're quite awkward, a bit fumbly. We might worry about saying the wrong thing. What are they going to think? You know, we get it wrong. There's things lost in translation. And I think if we knew how to have those conversations in a better, more productive, kind of less embarrassing, you know, we feel embarrassed and ashamed way, it would do a great service to all of our sex lives and intimacy, because the likelihood is our partner would probably understand and probably could relate to it in some way. And I think that's where the psychosexual therapy bit comes in, because sometimes people come to you to have those conversations.
Yeah.
In a space where they can be guided by someone.
Yeah. And I think that's why conversations like this is important for people to hear, because it's a situation I've been through. And if I wasn't aware enough that stress leads to less sleep and that leads to less testosterone, and that's why I feel less likely to want to have sex with my partner or just have sex at all, it has nothing to do with how our relationship is going and how I feel about that person sexually or attractive to that person. It really is to me. And, you know, lo and behold, I take care of my health. I eat well. You know, I was able to take care of my sleep. And all of a sudden, like, you have a boost of energy and, you know, back to your normal health mode. And I think it's important for people to maybe start with the basics of being able to get your sleep, drink enough water, take care of your health, your mental health, and do that step first. Because it is oftentimes the hormones in our bodies that are determining what decisions or what we're feeling. And it's not just blaming our partners or how we feel about them. As easier that is, it's really about taking care of the basics first and then doing all the things you mentioned.
Yeah. And I think the perfect example of what you've said there is then, so if we kind of took that a step further, we could say, okay, so in that instance, without the knowledge that you had of kind of hormones or how the body works or going for a testosterone test, you might have started thinking, oh, I wonder what's going on here. Maybe it is about my partner. Your partner might have been started saying, why are you not interested in me at the moment? What's going on? They've got their assumptions. You've got yours. You're thinking, oh, maybe I'm not interested. Okay, well, maybe, you know, this is the relationship not really working, or maybe, you know, we've just lost our sexual attraction for each other. Maybe it used to be there and now it isn't. And then that starts to create a pressure point around sex. And then that can have a knock-on effect on the relationship and a detrimental effect on the relationship, because the two of you can't have a conversation where you're breaking each other out of each other's assumptions. So you're both thinking something, but you're not able to confirm it with each other because you're not able to talk about sex. So you're left with just your assumptions. So you have a gap in your knowledge. And what you do with gaps in knowledge is you fill them in. and you're filling it in.
Usually
with
they're the worst
version.
Assumptions, right?
With always, exactly, the worst case scenario, because we have a negative bias as humans. And that then can have a really problematic impact on sex, because sex becomes a pressure point, a problem. We'd either rather avoid it, or we start to feel awkward about it. We get very in our heads. We might start to struggle with sexual functioning. We might not enjoy sex. We might not be able to orgasm because we're not in the moment, because we're so preoccupied by what's going on in our heads. And then that can become quite a vicious cycle that people get stuck in. And then the second bit that you said there is that kind of not understanding our bodies and knowing our bodies, and body knowledge is really important. You know, it's a huge thing that's embedded into the book, which is broken up into these different sections. One, which is how to know your body, how it functions, what's going on. So everything from how does the brain sense touch, to what happens when we orgasm, to, you know, vagina versus vulva, to the kind of anatomy bits, because if we don't know our normal, then when something changes, we can't really be aware or describe even to a professional or a medical professional or anything what's going on, because if we're comparing ourselves to someone else's normal, but it might be completely different from ours to start with, that's not useful information. Whereas for us, understanding, so the perfect example there is men waking up with erections. So we have nocturnal erections throughout the night, and often they men wake up with erections. We know that these gradually decline with age, along in line with testosterone levels gradually declining with age, with kind of muscle strength declining with age, lots of factors going on. But if they suddenly change and you are, for all other intensive purposes, kind of not having any problems, you need to go and see a doctor quite soon, quickly, actually, because it could be an indicator of other health concerns going on. So things like cardiac issues or issues with blood flow or circulation. That's a sudden change. But if you don't know that about your body, or it's something you haven't been noticing about your body, then you could actually be putting yourself at risk by not having that level of body knowledge. And for women as well, you know, making sure that they know their genitals, looking out for signs of kind of vulval cancers and things like that, their skin conditions. And we don't empower people to do that, and particularly around sex. You know, we know that appointments for difficulties with sex and genitals, anything to do with this, that they have a much slower uptake. People let symptoms go on longer than they should do because they feel embarrassed, or they don't want to go to doctors. And so it's an important part of the conversation is, please know your body, know your normal. And if you notice changes, things like bleeding, you know, after sex are really common, go and see your medical professional. You know, they are there to answer these type of questions. And they, you know, in some cases it can save lives.
Yeah, absolutely. There was a, this has nothing to do with what we just talked about, but there was a thing that I just, was a video that I was watching from Dr. Tara Schwartz. And she was talking about how when men have sex, we release testosterone almost every single time, and oxytocin only when we're actually in love with the partner, whereas women will release oxytocin every time they have sex. And I kind of wanted to slide this in into the topic of polygamy and having that conversation with you around how polygamy works when the mechanisms of how we have sex and the chemicals that are released is different from one gender to another. I mean, this is assuming heterosexual partners, right? For men and female, but knowing that when we have sex, we release different chemicals, how does that correlate with how successful polygamy can be in the long term?
So when we're kind of talking about polyamory, so we're talking about kind of, you know, I always say the clue's in the name, kind of consensual or ethical non-monogamy. So these are models of relationships that are outside of a what we call mononormative, so kind of two-person relationship. And I mean, there are hundreds of thousands of variations of how people can do this. I think that funnily enough, actually, you're saying that, that's the second time again this week that someone's talked to me about that study, and I don't know enough about it. But I think that, you know, with those multi-partner relationships, of course, the risks of attachment are always there. And I think that's why the social bit comes into it in such a big way, that people have kind of boundaries and agreements and contracts. And, you know, the thing that people always say is, don't people in, you know, non-monogamous relationships get jealous? Well, of course they do. They're humans, but they know how to manage that within the agreements that they've made or the boundaries that they've set. And, you know, we are obviously kind of chemically connecting with people, if we want to think about it that way, or having chemical releases with people when we are having sex with them or sexual relationships with them. And it's about how I think we, you know, what we decide to nurture within that or connect within that. I think I've not answered the question at all.
It's a hard one to ask. I mean, it's an answer, really, but really just a conversation of how you thought about how that could set people up to have polygamy, or if you believe that could work over time based on these different chemical mechanisms that happen for different genders.
Yeah, I think that, there's so much to dig into, isn't there? Because there's also such a social, such a kind of social narrative about the differences with men and women in these situations. And, you know, even things that we've been kind of had reinforced to us our whole lives, you know, things like men think about sex every 6 seconds and women don't, and these kind of gender norms, wow, you know, that they're, you know, that aren't necessarily true, but have kind of, you know, really these differences in how things are done have existed for a long time in the conversations and the setup. And, you know, the perfect example, if we still have an orgasm gap between, so in heterosexual couples, and this is research done and studied and written about by someone called Dr. Laurie Mintz, that in heterosexual couples, there is still something like a 30% orgasm gap between men and women's orgasms. So when men and women are having sex, men are having orgasms almost, you know, 90 to 100% of the time, and women are having orgasms about 60% of the time. And there's also a different layer to that, which is if you ask them if they reported their partner's orgasms, that gap closes, because we know that faking orgasms is a social element of that. And so men would report their partners orgasming when their partners would report not orgasming. So then you've got that kind of social layer, which is, okay, so why is that happening? And when we think about things like this, you know, so much of it is bedded in education and, you know, again, body knowledge, you know, what's working for people sexually.
Right. Yeah, there's something around, well, we can kind of slide into this and kind of close it off here, but the idea that I guess more men generally watch porn and they see that penetration leads to orgasm versus the reality is that the clitoris is what leads to orgasms for most women. And there is that knowledge gap there for most people that are thinking that, you know, just intercourse is leading to the orgasms that women are supposed to be having.
Yeah, absolutely. And even things like our terminology. So when people use the word vagina colloquially a lot of the time, what they actually mean is the vulva, which is the external genitals. And so by nature of saying vagina, which is the internal canal from the cervix of the womb down to the kind of entrance of the vagina, down to the vulva, the labia, that we are, by saying vagina and meaning the whole thing, we're eradicating the clitoris, you know, like that, because it's not included. And things like the fact that that's historically, that the word vulva wasn't, I mean, I never had the word vulva given to me in my sex education at school. And, you know, I'm a person with a vulva. And it's something that, how have we managed to kind of misname a part of people's anatomy for so long? And this is education, not just for men, but also for women. It's education for everyone. And yes, the focus has always been on intercourse as the only form of sex. And we know that sexual expression and sexual experiences can happen in so many ways. Mm. And for me, you know, I always go back to Emily Nagoski, who says pleasure is the measure. And I think it's just the perfect phrase for summing up, you know, the reason that so many people have sex in the first place.
Absolutely. Final question for you, whether it's sex, relationships, communication between couples, what is an actionable piece of advice or takeaway that people can implement in their lives today, whether it's with their partners or whether it's for themselves, that can ultimately lead them to have a healthier relationship or a better sex life?
It's actually one which doesn't involve any doing of sex. I would say whatever age, stage you are, you know, the importance of sex education across the lifetime is go and listen to someone talking about sex, you know, a podcast, a TED talk, pick up a book about sex or listen to an audiobook about sex. Listen to other people's perspectives and ideas, because I think so many of us, we kind of get this version, this definition or this version of sex, and then we never question it, we never challenge it, because we don't have the kind of culture of normalization or kind of knowing how we can talk about something or kind of, you know, feeling free to explore it in a really open way like we would lots of other things. And I think then if we can take that and we can just almost like slightly question like why we think what we think and why, and we might think, yeah, that really works for me, actually, that's good, you know, like the version I have really suits me and really fits me. But we know that it doesn't for lots of people. So we know that, you know, the most recent piece of research in the UK showed that 40% of people were dissatisfied with their sex lives in the UK. And there's something going on around that, which I think can be changed just by curiosity, just by listening to other people's perspectives, by exploring. And it requires no pressure, nothing to do. You know, you can sit on your commute and listen to it. No, it requires no action, but just for you to start thinking about sex a little bit differently, I think is something that everyone can do.
Well, I think a great way to start is your book. What is the new book called, and where can people find it?
The book is called The Science of Sex, Every Question About Your Sex Life Answered. It was published in September of this year, and it is over 100 questions of the, well, over 100 of the most asked sex and relationship questions. It's brilliantly illustrated by someone called Jocelyn, cut that bit because I can't pronounce her surname. It's beautifully illustrated by an amazing illustrator, and I think, you know, it's based in research and statistics, and the thing that we have tried to do is make it accessible, and so it's there for kind of all adults to know how to educate themselves.
Awesome. Kate, thanks so much for joining the show.
Thank you.